On the evening of November 20th, 1920, seven men met in the basement of a young women's school known as St. Ida's College in central Dublin. They came to plot murder. Not one, but many. At their head was the Irish Republican Army's Director of Intelligence and Chief Strategist, Michael Collins. With him were hand-picked assassins dubbed the 12 Apostles, or the Squad. The meeting capped weeks of preparation. Agents inside the British administration, plus a small army of barmen, cabbies, and maids, had provided the IRA with raw information to pinpoint the addresses and habits of the intended victims. The question was only how many of those victims there would be. The final list was set at about 20. The attacks would be at 9 a.m. the following morning. It would afterwards be known as Bloody Sunday. The Irish Republican Army was a tightly organized secret society battling the greatest power on earth, the British Empire. Michael Collins didn't have better arms or superior manpower. He knew he could succeed only by out-secreting and by out-conspiring his enemy. The Squad itself was a specialized secret cell within a larger one. Its members were carefully selected and sworn to absolute loyalty. The main objective of the coming attacks was to quash a rival secret group run out of Dublin Castle, the seat of British power in Ireland. Officially known as D Branch, it was later dubbed the Cairo Gang because many of its members frequented Dublin's Cairo Cafe. But no one used that name in 1920. Collins' men simply referred to their rivals as the Murder Gang. It was a select group of about 20 British officers, specially trained by Scotland Yard and MI5, and sent to Ireland to find and liquidate IRA members. For Collins and his men, it was kill or be killed. Cairo Gang members lived as civilians, often with wives and families in tow. They resided in hotels and boarding houses scattered throughout the city. To carry out Bloody Sunday, Collins organized teams to execute simultaneous attacks at 10 locations. There were 30 to 40 gunmen in all, including 14 members of the Squad. The next morning, when the clock struck 9, an IRA team led by Vinnie Byrne forced a terrified maid at 38 Upper Mount Street to point out the rooms of Captain George Bennett and Lieutenant Peter Ames. Taken half asleep, the officers were lined up, ordered to face a wall, and shot in the back of the head. At the same time, at 22 Lower Mount Street, a team under Tom Keogh gunned down Lieutenant Henry Inglis as he reached for his gun. His comrade, Charles Peel, locked himself in his room and survived a barrage of IRA bullets fired through the door. At the Gresham Hotel on O'Connell Street, an IRA trio, dressed as British soldiers, shot Captain Patrick McCormick and Lieutenant Leonard Wilde as they opened their door. The biggest single slaughter occurred at 28 Pembroke Street, where a team under Mick Flanagan first killed Major Charles Dowling and Captain Leonard Price, and then turned their pistols on Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Montgomery and Captain Brian Keenlyside. Keenlyside's wife threw herself between her husband and the shooters, but Flanagan pushed her aside and shot him dead. A fifth officer, Colonel Wilfred Woodcock, was just stopping by when he was shot, but he survived. At 117 Moorhampton Road, gunmen killed the suspected informer T.H. Smith and Lieutenant Donald McLean. McLean asked not to be shot in front of his wife and was obligingly dispatched in another room. Similar scenes played out elsewhere. By 10 a.m., 19 men had been shot, 14 fatally. A 15th, Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Montgomery, later died of his wounds. 9 were killed in their pajamas. Others were luckier. Some of Collins' targets slipped away or just weren't at home. Squad man Joe Dolan found Major Lorraine King's half-naked girlfriend, however. He slapped her around and set fire to the room. Of the dead, only about half were actually intelligence officers. Some were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. At least 7 of the Cairo gang escaped altogether. Still, the day's bloodshed wasn't over. As word of the shooting spread, so did a desire for revenge. Shortly after 3 p.m., a force of British auxiliaries, known as the Black and Tans, stormed into Croke Park, where thousands of spectators were watching a football match between Dublin and Tipperary. Firing indiscriminately, they killed 14 persons and wounded at least 60. The murder gang would soon reform and was never again penetrated by the IRA. But Bloody Sunday was a critical psychological victory for the Irish rebels. It showcased their cunning and ruthlessness and highlighted British vulnerability. Moreover, the Croke Park massacre cost the British any claim to moral superiority. Some 6 months later, reluctant British politicians, including Winston Churchill, accepted a truce. That led to a December 1921 treaty that would create the Irish Free State. Bloody Sunday wasn't an end or a beginning. It was an episode in a struggle that had begun centuries before and would continue for decades more. And it's still not over today. And it wasn't the only episode in which secret societies played a role. English rule in Ireland dates back to the 12th century, when English kings began calling themselves Lords of Ireland. In 1542, Henry VIII took the title of King of Ireland. Another turning point was a bloody period of war and rebellion in the 17th century. Almost a third of Ireland's population perished. The native Irish nobility was decimated and dispossessed. In its place rose what's known as the Protestant Ascendancy. The dominance of the Protestant landowning elite over the Catholic population was sealed by the 1690 Battle of the Boyne. The Catholic majority was mostly reduced to impoverished peasantry and subjected to harsh penal laws. Catholics couldn't hold public office, marry Protestants, possess or inherit large estates, or even own a horse worth more than £5 sterling. There was resistance, but it had to be clandestine, and that called for secret societies. In the mid-18th century came the White Boys, so-called because they wore white smocks on nocturnal escapades. They attacked landlord agents and tax collectors. But they dreamed of a tumultuous rising to overthrow the Protestant elite. In the 1780s, Northern Ireland saw the rise of the Catholic defenders and their Protestant enemies, the Peepo Day Boys. These were oath-bound secret orders that mimicked the Freemasons. They even organized in lodges. In the case of the Peepo Day, many members were also Freemasons. In 1795, this rivalry led to a pitched battle won by the Protestants. The same year, the Peepo Days morphed into the Loyal Orange Institution, or Orange Order. Again modeled on the Freemasons, the Orangemen swore to uphold the Protestant ascendancy. Curious where the orange comes in? It was homage to William of Orange, the Dutch Protestant ruler named King of England in 1689. It was his army that won the Battle of the Boyne in 1690 and secured the Protestant ascendancy. The battle's anniversary, dubbed the Glorious 12th of July, is still observed each year. Naturally, Irish Catholics saw this as a bitter reminder of their subjugation and oppression. And that's exactly what Orangemen intended. But there were other forces at work as well. In 1791, a new secret society known as the United Irishmen appeared in Belfast. It was different because it included Catholics and dissident Protestants alike. The United Irishmen were also influenced by the recent American Revolution and the one underway in France. The Americans showed that successful rebellion against English rule was possible. The French Revolution introduced more radical notions. In 1793, United Irishmen adopted oaths and passwords to become a true secret society. Then they went underground. Not coincidentally, Britain went to war with revolutionary France that same year. Believing that England's difficulty was Ireland's opportunity, the United Irishmen opened secret negotiations with Paris. In 1796, a plan to land 14,000 French troops in Ireland fizzled. But London responded with martial law. Still, the United Irishmen expanded to an estimated 200,000 members. Things came to a head in 1798, later dubbed the Year of the French. Led by the Protestant Irish revolutionary, Wolfe Tone, the United Irishmen launched an uncoordinated rebellion. Betrayed by informers, a plan to seize Dublin failed. Hoped-for French intervention arrived too little, too late. Piecemeal rural uprisings went on for months. All were snuffed out. Wolfe Tone was captured by the British and sentenced to hang, but he never made it to the gallows. Depending on the story, he either slit his own throat or was murdered by his jailers. 1798 ended in a disaster that produced plenty of martyrs, but no relief from English rule. In 1801, things got worse. A new Act of Union abolished the Irish Parliament, the last vestige of autonomy. But the secret societies didn't give up. The United Irishmen reformed as rural oath-bound lodges with names like the Fraternal Society and the Sons of the Shamrock. Collectively, they were called Ribbon Men because of the green ribbon that they wore as a sign of recognition. The Ribbon Men conducted a low-level guerrilla war against landlords, officials, and above all, their mortal enemies, the Protestant Orange Order. In 1829, the British Parliament repealed the anti-Catholic laws, but the Protestant ascendancy clung to power. Inspired by nationalist movements on the continent, a new society known as Young Ireland arose in the 1840s. In July 1848, following the revolutionary events in France and Germany, Young Ireland launched another failed uprising. Ireland was also in the grip of a natural disaster, the Great Famine. By 1851, Ireland had lost nearly a third of its population to starvation and emigration, mostly to the United States. By the late 19th century, there were more Irish in America than in the old country. Along with them came Irish secret societies. The first to appear in the States in 1836 was the Ancient Order of Hibernians. It was again based on the Masonic model. To belong, one had to be male, Catholic, and born in Ireland, or of Irish descent. The Hibernians presented themselves as a peaceful fraternal order. However, most founding members were linked to the Ribbon Men. Hibernians outwardly opposed Irish independence, but supported home rule, which meant limited self-government under the British Empire. They also maintained their bitter feud with the Orange Order in America. A radical offshoot of the Hibernians were the Molly Maguires, who sprang up in the Pennsylvania coal country during the 1870s. They were a cross between a labor union and a criminal gang. Joining the Irish exodus to America were John O'Mahony and Michael Doheny. Both were veterans of the failed Young Ireland group. In 1854, they inaugurated a new society in New York, the Fenian Brotherhood, which took its name from a band of mythical Irish warriors known as the Fianna. In the years following, Fenian became the generic name for Irish rebels. The Fenian Brotherhood had a sister society, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, formed in Dublin at the same time. Because the Fenian Brotherhood could operate freely in America, they became the more important of the two societies. But the Brotherhoods had similar problems, factional quarrels and informers. The Fenian Brotherhood's great opportunity came at the close of the American Civil War. Thousands of Irishmen fought in the conflict, creating a large reservoir of experienced officers and soldiers of Irish descent. One was ex-Union General Thomas Sweeney, a native of County Cork. Another was General John O'Neill. Yet another was O'Neill's friend, Union Army veteran Henri Le Caron. Caron's real name was Thomas Beach, and he was a British agent. The grand scheme of the American Fenians was an invasion of Canada. After seizing Montreal and other cities, they would offer to swap them for the freedom of their Irish homeland. The idea wasn't as silly as it sounds. The Fenians raised a large war chest by selling dubious bonds redeemable by a future Irish republic. They used the cash to arm and equip thousands of volunteers. Sympathetic American officials made no effort to interfere with the plot. The first invasion got underway in spring 1866. An amphibious operation to seize Campobello Island near Maine came to nothing. But a force of 1,000 Civil War veterans under General O'Neill crossed the border at Buffalo and seized Fort Erie, Ontario. A sharply worded protest from London to Washington eventually made the U.S. government take action. Army troops cut off supplies and reinforcements to O'Neill's little army, dooming its advance. But the Fenians were persistent. In 1867, the Brotherhood held a rally in Philadelphia featuring 6,000 armed men. In April 1870, General O'Neill rallied a new force of 1,300 in Vermont. They crossed into Quebec with high hopes. But the Canadian militia was already ready and waiting. A single volley from the Canadians sent O'Neill's men scurrying back across the border. His force was the first to call itself the Irish Republican Army. Canadians instead joked that the initials stood for "I ran away." What O'Neill never suspected was that the agent of his failure was his friend and comrade, Henri Le Caron, the British agent. A year later, Le Caron again tipped off the Canadians about a plan to launch an invasion out of North Dakota. It, too, failed. The Canadian invasion splintered and discredited the Fenian Brotherhood. The more radical among them reorganized under a new label, the Clan na Gael. And in 1881, they decided to challenge England at sea. American inventor John Holland was commissioned to build a submarine dubbed the Fenian Ram to attack British merchant vessels and warships. Holland did his job, but the Irish refused to pay and stole the sub. However, they had no idea how to operate it, and Holland wasn't going to tell them how. The submarine ended up in a Connecticut barn where it sat and rusted until 1916. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the Irish Republican Brotherhood hatched its own plans. These involved another new invention, dynamite. In December 1867, Irish Republican Brotherhood men tried to use the explosive to blow open London's Clerkenwell prison and release a captured comrade. Instead, they destroyed nearby houses, killing 12 innocent people and injuring 100. But again, they didn't give up. From 1881 through 1885, an Irish Republican Brotherhood faction under the Irish-American Jeremiah O'Donovan Rosa waged the so-called dynamite campaign. Today, we'd call them terrorist bombings. The targets weren't in Ireland, but in England and Scotland. Rosa aimed to bring the war home to the British government and population. In Dublin's Phoenix Park in May 1882, another breakaway faction, the Irish National Invincibles, carried out the daylight knife murders of the newly appointed Secretary of Ireland, Lord Cavendish, and the Irish Permanent Undersecretary, Thomas Burke. These atrocities definitely got the attention of Her Majesty's government. The best way to fight a secret society is with another one. Scotland Yard created what would become the Special Branch. Its most effective director was himself an Irish Catholic, William Melville, who became the bane of the Fenians. Melville made effective use of informers and provocateurs. His biggest success was thwarting something known as the Jubilee Plot, a Fenian scheme to blow up Queen Victoria and her government at Westminster Abbey in June 1887. Or maybe not. Plot organizer Francis Millen was a member of Clan na Gael, but also one of Melville's provocateurs. Some suspected the whole thing was instigated by Melville to discredit the popular moderate Irish politician Charles Parnell. Once more, Henri Le Caron was involved. Le Caron had reported that Parnell, outwardly a backer of home rule, maintained secret communication with Clan na Gael and the Irish Republican Brotherhood. These setbacks left Irish secret societies thwarted, divided, and demoralized. But they weren't giving up. In 1914, another difficulty for England offered them yet another opportunity. That, of course, was war with Germany. But just before war broke out, Ireland was gripped by a fresh political crisis, setting the stage for all that followed. The British Parliament was set to approve Home Rule for Ireland. It would have established a separate Irish Parliament to handle internal affairs, while Ireland remained part of the United Kingdom. But a restored Irish Parliament was bound to be controlled by the Catholic majority. That especially alarmed the Orange Order. In response, Orangemen formed the Ulster Volunteers, a 100,000-strong militia determined to resist Home Rule by force. In turn, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, backed by the ancient Order of Hibernians, formed the Irish Volunteers. They claimed up to 200,000 members. Caught in the middle was the British Army. But most British officers in Ireland were themselves Protestants, and many were members of the Orange Order. In March 1914, nearly 100 officers of the Irish garrison threatened to resign and join the Ulster Volunteers. Loyalty to Faith and Lodge trumped loyalty to king and country. Civil war loomed. The crisis was only averted by the outbreak of the European War. The Home Rule Bill passed, but the British government decided to kick the can down the road and suspended it for the duration. This convinced wavering nationalists that London would never surrender control. One such nationalist was Sir Roger Casement, a man who loyally served the crown and gained international acclaim for daring exposés of colonial injustices in the Congo and in the Amazon. Hence, the knighthood. But those investigations had also turned Casement into an enemy of imperialism and a champion of Irish independence. Though he helped form the Irish Volunteers, Casement had a secret. He was gay, and that played a critical part in his eventual fate. In July 1914, as storm clouds gathered over Europe, Casement suddenly went to New York, where he met with Clan na Gael and with German agents. The Clan and the Irish Republican Brotherhood were itching to organize a new insurrection. Casement asked the Germans for help, and they tentatively agreed. To seal the deal, he headed back across the Atlantic to take his case directly to Kaiser Wilhelm. In Norway, British agents picked up Casement's companion, a Norwegian named Adler Christensen. The Brits offered Christensen the equivalent of about $300,000 today to kill Casement. Christensen declined, but he confirmed that the men's relationship was unnatural. And in Berlin, Casement got a cool reception. He never met the Kaiser. German officials finally offered 20,000 captured Russian rifles and 10 machine guns, but no advisors. Casement was, to say the least, disappointed. Meanwhile, back in Dublin, the IRB planned feverishly. At the center of the conspiracy was a 7-man war council, another secret society within a secret society. Its fighting force was mainly drawn from the Irish Volunteers. Also roped in was the smaller Irish Citizen Army, a militia of socialist workmen. There were even 200 female volunteers. The day of the uprising was set for Easter Sunday, April 1916. Much depended on the promised arms from Germany. But just about everything that could go wrong did. Tipped off by informers, the British intercepted the freighter carrying the arms. Its captain scuttled the ship, and with it, the rifles and machine guns. A German U-boat dropped Casement on a deserted beach on the west coast of Ireland. By now, he was certain the rebellion would be a fiasco and wanted to call it off. That wasn't to be. Apprehended by a passing constable, Casement was quickly recognized and hustled off to London. Unsure and getting cold feet, some rebel leaders cautioned delay, but most were bound and determined to go ahead. In Dublin, the Irish rebels mustered around 1,200 fighters. Opposing them were 16,000 British soldiers and 1,000 Royal Irish Constabulary. In the countryside, another 2,000 to 3,000 rebels gathered in small groups. A much larger number simply stayed home. Everything was set for another glorious failure. The leaders of the Dublin rebels, men like teacher and writer Patrick Pearse and socialist labor organizer James Connolly, weren't crazy enough to believe they could defeat the British Army. They planned to seize the post office, city hall, and other key buildings and hold them long enough to secure international recognition. Against overwhelming odds, they held out for 6 days. In the end, nearly 500 people were killed, almost half innocent civilians. Much of central Dublin lay in ruins. 66 rebels lay dead, as did almost 150 British soldiers. The British summarily executed 15 or 16 captured leaders of the opposition, including Pearse and Connolly. They also rounded up more than 3,000 Irish civilians, most of them completely innocent. For the rebels, a psychological victory was snatched from the jaws of military defeat. One of the rebels fighting at the Dublin post office was Michael Collins, who narrowly avoided execution and went on to lead the underground Irish Republican Army. Roger Casement wasn't so lucky. Convicted of high treason, he was hanged in London in August 1916. His prior service and renown might have won him clemency, but for one thing. Scotland Yard revealed Casement's homosexuality, producing the so-called Black Diaries, in which Casement supposedly recorded, in vivid detail, his encounters with men and boys. Whether the diaries were legitimate or forgery is still a matter of controversy. If the British thought they had won, they were mistaken. A movement based on secret societies is hard to destroy. Elections were held in Ireland in December 1918. The Sinn Féin Party, the legal political wing of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, swept to victory. In January 1919, nationalist militants, including Michael Collins, proclaimed Irish independence. The War of Independence was on. From past history, Collins drew important lessons. The bane of Irish nationalism had been factionalism and betrayal. Thus, as the IRA's adjutant general and director of intelligence, he demanded unquestioned loyalty and obedience. Collins organized the squad to eliminate informers in IRA ranks first. He avoided pitched battles. By operating the IRA not as an army, but as an armed secret society, Collins frustrated and stymied the might of the British Empire. The Irish Free State formed in early 1922, but it didn't secure full independence or Irish unity. While the Free State had internal autonomy, it was still a dominion of the British Crown. Members of the Irish Parliament had to swear an oath of fidelity to the King. You can imagine how most felt about that. Worst to many had been the separation of predominantly Protestant Ulster into a separate Northern Ireland, still attached to Britain. Collins argued that these compromises, hateful as they were, gave Ireland the freedom to attain freedom. Others rejected the treaty and vowed to keep fighting. The fledgling Irish state was plunged into civil war. IRA brothers became enemies. In August 1922, Michael Collins was killed in an ambush by anti-treaty forces. In the long run, though, he was again proved right. In the 1930s, the Irish Free State became the Republic of Ireland, and in 1949, it threw off the last ties to the United Kingdom. Still, peace didn't break out. To die-hard nationalists, the job was unfinished. An underground IRA, bent on unification, maintained its secret existence. Before and during World War II, IRA factions aligned themselves with the Soviet Union and German Nazis to continue the struggle against England. In the 1960s, a new generation, calling itself the Provisional Irish Republican Army, launched the so-called Troubles. For 30 years, IRA violence and retaliation by the British Army and Orange-backed Ulster Defense Association kept Northern Ireland in a state of war. The Troubles also spawned a new terrorist bombing campaign in England. The Good Friday Peace Agreement of 1998 officially ended the troubles. But a secretive faction calling itself the real IRA won't give up, even today. As in the American and French revolutions, secret societies were no minor sideshow in the Irish struggle for freedom. They were at the heart of it. And despite innumerable glorious failures, Irish independence would never have been achieved without them. The Irish case also highlights two perennial traits of secret societies. First, their resiliency, the ability to reform, rename, and adapt while single-mindedly pursuing their goals. Second, the tendency to splinter into rival factions. Michael Collins' success arose from his understanding of the reasons for past failures. And yet, it was his own secret society, not the power of the British Empire, that killed him.